Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. We're continuing our series of election-oriented interviews, and today my guest is Michael Cranish. He's the Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe and the co-author of The Real Romney, widely considered the definitive biography of the Republican presidential nominee. He's also the author of Flight from Monticello, Thomas Jefferson at War, and co-author of John F. Kerry, The Complete Biography. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Were there any particularly formative experiences for Mitt Romney growing up, or in adulthood even, which inform the way that he approaches political leadership now?
Well, absolutely. You know, he grew up the son of George Romney, the governor of Michigan and presidential candidate in 1968, and really learned at his father's side. It was long thought that Mitt would be the one to follow George into politics. And for example, in 1964, George Romney went to the National Republican Convention in San Francisco, and there he wasn't directly campaigning for the presidency, but some people wanted him to be the candidate against Barry Goldwater, the conservative nominee. At that convention, he tried to get a more moderate plank adopted. He wanted them to reject extremism. He wanted them to adopt a platform for civil rights. Barry Goldwater had just voted against civil rights legislation in 1964. Mitt, as a 17-year-old, was by his father's side in 1964. So right there at the convention, he's seeing what happens. His father's calls to reject extremism are rejected. And as Mitt Romney later told the story, his father walked out of that convention in 1964. So isn't it interesting that all these years later, just a few weeks ago, Mitt Romney walks into the Republican convention. He's the nominee. He goes in calling himself, as he said earlier this year, quote, severely conservative, unquote. And in effect, has won over today's Barry Goldwater wing of the party. So whereas his father was fighting that wing as a moderate, here's Mitt Romney now to win the nomination, really had to be quite conservative and cast himself that way. And of course, the challenge is now that we're facing the general election, he needs to put himself a little bit back towards the middle. So it's been a challenge for Mitt Romney throughout his life. But it seems clear that in so many ways he's following in his father's footsteps. And yet today's party is so different from his father's party.
Is that dynamic of lessons learned from the father similar in some ways to George W. Bush and George H.W. Bush, where he saw his father lose in part as he understood it because he wasn't conservative enough, and so he fixed that when he got into the presidency? Is there any kind of similar dynamic?
You know, people have talked about the parallels there, and I did cover the George H.W. Bush presidency and some of the George W. Bush presidency, and they certainly governed differently and had different approaches. But even if you look back at George W. Bush, let's put aside the foreign policy things. We could talk about that separately. But on some domestic things, you know, he called himself a compassionate conservative. So even he was trying to win over some people a little bit more in the middle. He favored a prescription drug plan that conservatives today don't like a lot. In the case of Mitt Romney, he hasn't called himself in that same way, although clearly as the weeks go on, I think you'll see a little bit more of that appeal to the middle. He's talked a little bit more recently about compromise and working with Democrats, you know, if he could. Of course, people always say that going into an election. We'll have to see what happens.
You mentioned also his father not getting this thing through. Is this a guy who is defined more by what he's succeeded at and his wins or his losses in life?
Well, that's a great question. Mitt Romney, when he first ran for public office, it's 1994. He's running against Ted Kennedy, the liberal lion in Massachusetts. It was a rather audacious thing to think about. At that point, Mitt Romney had been very successful in business, Bain Capital. But few people, other than knowing that he was the son of George Romney, really knew much about him. He had very low name recognition in 1994. He did, at a certain point, run pretty strongly against Ted Kennedy. Very interestingly, in that race, he cast himself as he had been independent. He boasted about voting for a Democratic presidential primary candidate, Paul Tsongas, in 1992. He said he was an independent during the time of Reagan Bush. He favored abortion rights. He said he was better on gay rights than Ted Kennedy. So he really was running as a pretty liberal Republican. And he opposed the Contract with America in 1994 that Newt Gingrich was pushing. So the party was going off more in that Gingrich, more conservative direction. Romney, to try to win the Senate seat, was staying in a more liberal, maybe moderate position in 1994. It didn't work. He lost. But when he ran again in 2002, he had learned some lessons. He still ran very much down the middle. He called himself a moderate. He said he was a progressive. And he won election to be governor. And he was a pretty popular governor in Massachusetts, where there are a lot of independents. It's known as a very democratic state, but really there's a lot of independents there as well. We have a history in Massachusetts of electing a number of Republican governors in recent years. And he put through a health care plan that he didn't even campaign for. This was something he came up with while he was in the governorship. And that was a very popular piece of legislation. And Ted Kennedy, who he'd fought so bitterly in the 1994 Senate race, stood behind Mitt Romney when Romney signed that health care legislation. It was a funny story. One of Romney's sons was at the signing ceremony for the health care bill. And looking at Ted Kennedy plauding Mitt Romney, one of Romney's sons said, well, we've just solved climate change because hell just froze over. And it gives you a sense about how extraordinary the change, you know, that he could get along, and he was working with Democrats at that point. As he was governor, though, his aides were talking about with him, you know, running for the presidency, something that Romney had talked about wanting to do over a period of time. And they could see, according to ones I've talked to, that you couldn't become the Republican nominee if you were known as a liberal to moderate Massachusetts Republican. And whether it's a coincidence or not, Romney's positions did begin to shift on some issues. He said he had an epiphany and opposed abortion rights. And he did try to present himself as more conservative. And so by the time he got into the middle of his governorship, he was already talking to folks around the country about running for the presidency and seeing where that would go. So this has been something that he's been working on for a long time.
I want to come back to that aspect of the real Romney a little bit later. But let me stick with something that is more general about the person as a person. He seems to have struggled with the empathy relatability side of the candidate equation. And that problem has taken different forms along the way in the campaign. So how empathetic is this guy with different types of people who are outside of the corporate and mainstream elite circles now?
Because he is someone who grew up in a very rarefied atmosphere, he grew up in what we call in the book a series of bubbles. He grew up in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, one of the wealthiest communities in the country. His father was the head of American Motors and then the governor of Michigan. So he had a pretty protected childhood in that way, went to an elite prep school called Cranbrook. He's a member of the Mormon religion, so that has its own sort of closed circle, if you will. And in Michigan, there were relatively few Mormons, and his father was a leader in the Mormon church in Michigan. So throughout his life, he was not, for example, you know, the backslapping, gregarious politician that we all might have an image of. He didn't run for the city council. He wasn't a mayor. His first stab at political office was the U.S. Senate, as I mentioned a few minutes ago. And if you talk to folks who are legislators in Massachusetts, a number of them will say that they weren't sure that Romney knew their names because he wasn't one to hang out a lot himself with legislators. He has a small circle of trusted advisors. It's something that has followed Romney throughout his life. Same thing at Bain Capital and same thing today in running for the presidency. Some of the same people who were his advisors when he was governor are also very much involved in running the presidential campaign. So there seems to be a small group. And I'm not saying that he doesn't understand the problems of average people. He has tried to make clear that he does. Obviously, he's extremely wealthy, worth at least $250 million by some accounts and maybe much more. But if you are that kind of person who is very wealthy, there are people who manage to nonetheless break through. He's had some problems connecting with people, and he's tried to change that perception. Recently, he's begun talking about his leadership of the Mormon Church in Massachusetts, not something he talked about a lot because people have had questions about his faith and so forth. He doesn't talk about the tenets of the faith. What he's tried to do is say, look, as a leader of the church in Massachusetts, I help people who are disadvantaged. People came to me. They may have been from all walks of life. They didn't have money. I advise them what to do. In the book, my co-author, Scott Hellman, writes a chapter about part of this life and some of the things that he advised folks are more controversial. But the way Romney's tried to do it, including at the convention in Tampa, is to say, you know, I did, you know, interact with people who are much less fortunate with me, and I tried to understand their problems and help them. So he's tried to use that in a way that he hadn't done previously to talk a little bit about his faith and a little bit more about connecting with average people.
And some people thought that was the most effective part of the convention. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Michael Krenisch, co-author of The Real Romney. Let me ask you a couple of questions about his religion. You just brought that up. How has his Mormonism influenced his political decision-making or his issue positions?
Well, this clearly made a big difference on him as a person. He would say, and he said many times, that you know he's not his positions are not dictated by the Mormon Church, and they won't tell him what to do as president and so forth. So he's tried to use pretty much the John F. Kennedy line on this and talking about when JFK famously said that he wouldn't take directions from Rome. So but clearly the Mormon faith is extraordinarily important to Mitt Romney. He has said, for example, that his faith is, quote, one of the most important treasures of my life, unquote. That pretty much tells you what you need to know. He is a deeply religious person, and he was brought up in a family that is intertwined, really, with the history of the Mormon faith.
It's been this curious cycle almost of interest and then lack of attention to his religion, at least on the media. On the one hand, people talk about it. Then on the other, it's something that can't be talked about. So what do you make of that?
Well, the way we write about it, as a reporter, I went when the Globe did a 7-part series in 2007 about Mitt Romney. Part of my assignment was to tell the whole Romney family history. And what's interesting about it, I mentioned a minute ago how they were so intertwined. There came a time when polygamy was banned in this country. Of course, Mormon, in the early days of Mormonism, they encouraged this among some people. And it was Mitt's great-grandfather who was told by the church leaders to go to Mexico and create a colony where polygamy could continue to flourish. And so that's what he did. He had four wives down there, and they did create this very wonderful, beautiful colony. I've been there, and it really is a magnificent setting in the Sierras down there in Mexico. And there are Romney's cousins who live there today. So this is not ancient history. Mitt's father, George Romney, was born in this colony and then emigrated to this country when he was 5 years old when there was a revolution in Mexico. I had not heard Mitt Romney talk much about this aspect of his father's life until this campaign. And in this campaign, he has talked, especially when talking to Hispanic audiences, reminding them that his father came from Mexico.
And was his father born into a polygamous family?
Mitt's great-grandfather, as I mentioned, did create this colony, but Mitt's grandfather had a traditional marriage, as did George. So it goes back a couple of generations.
I want to come back to something I mentioned earlier, which is this question of the real Romney in terms of how moderate the guy really is. And you talked about his evolution as governor. So, yes, as governor, he looked like he was a moderate for a large period of that time, the health care program that you mentioned. Observers like David Brooks keep telling us now that's who he really is. But Massachusetts has a particular political context, and now he's in a different political context. So let me put the question about the real Romney this way. Who's the Romney that we'll have after the oath of office if he wins, if we were to put him on some kind of axis of political views?
Well, I mean, that is the question I'm asked all the time. It really was the reason that the book was titled the way it was, because this question has existed for a very long time. Who is he really? Because the question isn't, has he changed positions? That's undeniable. The question is why? And then that leads to the question of, is it because of political ambition? He's just doing what's convenient for him politically, or has he had a heartfelt change of position? He would certainly say the latter on issues like abortion, for example. Talk to a number of people about this issue, and what typically I hear back is that his background is in business. And as a business person, you have to understand the market, understand how the market changes, and adapt to that.
Thy customer.
Right. And so in this case, what some people would say is that he's sort of a market-oriented politician in the sense that in Massachusetts, the market is liberal to moderate. Republican primaries is obviously more conservative. He called himself, quote, severely conservative. Now, is that because he's an opportunist? It's really for the voters to decide, what they think. But clearly, those positions have changed. And then to answer your question about, well, what would he be as president? I'm asked that all the time. It's very hard to predict because we don't know the makeup of Congress or the issues that he'll face. So I'll hedge a little bit because we just don't know those two key factors. But if you look at what happened in Massachusetts, he dealt with a legislature that was about 85% Democratic. He found ways time and again to work with them. He found a way to pass health care reform, working with them and getting support from liberals in the state and a health care plan that today is still pretty popular. So that tells you that he, when he wants to, he certainly can work with people across the aisle. Whether he comes into Washington and if he's got a Congress that's a very conservative Republican controlling both houses, then you would think that he would want to stick to his campaign promises and that they would try to make sure that he does so. If he has a more divided legislature, if one chamber is Democratic, one's Republican, if you look at what he did in Massachusetts, then you would think he'd try to be pragmatic and find ways to accomplish things because that's what he says he wants to do. So he's not been a base conservative politician that, no matter what, here's our issue. But in running for the primaries, he's sort of had to present himself that way to reassure those base conservatives who are really important in the primaries. So I think it will depend very much on the makeup of Congress, how Republican conservative it is or Democratic it is, and then specifically what issues might come up that we just can't even imagine today. I've covered the White House as well as presidential campaigns, and I've seen time and again a candidate will run for office and he'll deal with the issues that are present during the campaign, lo and behold, it gets into office and it changes. The best example is George W. Bush said he'd have a humble foreign policy. He didn't obviously anticipate 9/11, and obviously after 9/11, he couldn't have a humble foreign policy. And we didn't anticipate at the time that his presidency would be defined by foreign policy, but that's the way it worked out.
And corporate types often are big delegators. Does he have a particular style in that way?
Well, you know, there's this thing called the Bain Way, which is named after Bain Capital, and there are different definitions that I've heard about the Bain Way. But one definition is that he likes to have a number of people at the table and hear them discuss their views and argue the views, almost like it's a Harvard, you know, case study. And he was a Harvard Law School and Business School graduate. And hear the arguments back and forth and not try to impose his views so that he dictates the conversation, but listen to all the competing views. And I've been told by several people that his style would be to then close the meeting and not reveal, you know, what he thinks, but to go to various people who would disagree with each other separately, privately, and say, well, so-and-so said this. How about coming to this point? Maybe you guys can agree on this. In the end, if you are the president, you need to be the person making the decision. So I don't know if the way he operated at Bain and in the last campaign will really be the way that he might operate as president. But he has tried to be a leader in the sense of a little bit behind the scenes and letting different visions be played out in front of him. That's what he says.
In case you just joined us, you're listening to The Campbell Conversations, and I'm speaking with Michael Cranish, the co-author of The Real Romney. Well, here's a question I'm sure you get asked many times. Why hasn't he released more tax returns?
Well, it's a really good question. The Boston Globe has been asking for the tax returns going back 18 years. Let me give you a little perspective. In 1994, when Mitt Romney ran against Ted Kennedy, he challenged Ted Kennedy to release his taxes, saying if Kennedy had nothing to hide, then Kennedy would release his taxes. And Romney said, if you release your taxes, I'll release mine, like two kids at the schoolyard. Well, Kennedy didn't want to release his taxes, and Romney said, oh, okay, well, I won't release my taxes. So his tax returns were never released at that time. Then and he went back to Bain Capital after losing that race. Then in 2002, when Romney ran for the governorship, he was asked to release his taxes because his opponents in that race were releasing their taxes. And this time, Romney said, well, I was wrong. I shouldn't have said I'll release my taxes in 1994. It's a privacy issue. I'm not going to release my tax returns. A lot had happened between 1994 and 2002. Romney had been at Bain Capital. There were extraordinarily successful years. He'd made tens and tens of millions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars. And there's a lot of information in those returns that might tell us a lot about how he personally profited from certain deals, including deals that may have caused people to lose jobs. We don't know because we haven't seen the tax returns. It might tell us about his tax rate payment. We know that in recent years he's paid around 13%. It may have even been lower then. We just don't know. There's a lot of questions involving a lot of money and the years from 84 to 2002 when he was at Bain Capital and then the 10 years after when he was getting basically a lot of payments in a severance deal, they might tell us a lot. We don't have any of those years. We have 2010, and we're going to get 2011 apparently before the campaign's over.
And how do you write a book like this without triple and quadruple editing yourself even before you set pen to paper? Because you know that it's going to get scrutinized for every possible hint of bias. So how do you write under those circumstances?
Well, it's the same way we really try to do something with a newspaper story. You know, we're proudly mainstream in the sense that we're accountable and we want to be fair. We don't have an agenda, despite what some people might think about the newspaper business. And the book has been widely reviewed as being fair. To do that, you know, it was edited by a Boston Globe editor. There's 1,200 footnotes in the book because we wanted everything to check out. You know, we used a couple of fact checkers. So we went to extraordinary lengths, knowing ahead of time, you know, that there would be people trying to pick things apart. And we really did try to be complete and fair. And because it's an interesting story. People have often told me, gee, this is more interesting than Romney has talked about himself, because there are many aspects of his life that he doesn't want to talk about on the campaign trail, whether it be his governorship in Massachusetts or his Mormon faith or his upbringing, his privileged background, all sorts of things that are integral to understanding who Mitt Romney is, but they're not necessarily good talking points on the campaign trail.
Do you have a particularly favorite nugget that didn't go into the book that you can tell me now?
Well, if there was a favorite, I certainly would have put it in the book. I wouldn't keep something favorite. There are a lot of things I learned that, although the Globe has covered Romney for many years, there's a lot of things that I learned in doing the book because, you know, it's like a puzzle. There are pieces that you see, okay, someone back then wrote something, and now with new information or new knowledge or new research, I now understand what was going on there. So I'll give you one very brief example, and that is from the years at Bain Capital. If you listen to Mitt Romney talk about Bain Capital, what you'll certainly hear is him talk about his experience with Staples and the investment that Romney, early in his days at Bain Capital, made into Staples. And Staples is a store that practically everybody knows and probably buys things at. So it's a good example for him to use. If you look at the figures, however, Bain Capital put $2.5 million into Staples and then got a return of $13 million. That's a nice return for anybody, but it's not a big number in the scope of Bain Capital and the way Mitt Romney actually made his money. That was in the days, early days, when he was doing mostly venture capital deals to help start up new businesses. He pretty quickly switched out of venture capital into a much more controversial field called leverage buyouts. That's actually where Mitt Romney made most of his money. And to give you one example, there's a deal that I found out about that I hadn't seen written about, although I saw one passing reference by Romney to it, where they put in $50 million into an Italian Yellow Pages company. So there's no U.S. jobs involved. This is not a U.S. deal where created or loss of jobs. This was a company in Italy that an Italian partner had recommended. They put in $50 million. It turned into an internet-type company, unbeknownst really to the planning of this deal. And in the end, Bain Capital made about $1 billion. Romney himself may have made $20, $30, or even $40 million on this one deal for various reasons that are described in the book. So it probably was the most profitable deal or one of the most profitable he ever did. But if you compare Staples, not taking anything away from Staples, but that's $2.5 million in, $13 million out. This is $50 million in, $1 billion out. That's actually the kind of deal where Mitt Romney made the bulk of his money.
And finally, let me get to the three questions. As we've done sometimes in the past, when it makes sense, I'd like you to answer these from the perspective of the person you've written about rather than yourself, if you're game.
Sure.
Okay, here's the first one. What's the title of the chapter of life Mitt Romney is currently living?
Well, he hopes it's his dream year, depending on what happens with the election. I'm sure it's a very difficult year. You know, running for the presidency, I've covered campaigns going back to 84. It's a very hard enough to cover them. It's hard to imagine even running as the candidate yourself. I'm sure it's a very difficult, trying year, but you've got such a prize at the end of the exercise that obviously, you know, you keep on trying to do it. So I think the name of this chapter would only be known when the election's over.
Second, what's Romney's worst trait?
Well, again, as a reporter, I'm not going to say what, you know, if I think something's worst, but, you know, clearly something that's dogged him for a very long time is his difficulty connecting with average people, since he's a very wealthy person, hasn't really lived an average life, if you will, because of his rarefied upbringing. That's been something that's been difficult. And to be president, you've got to show that you've got empathy. It's one of the key things. People need to have an innate sense that you get it, that you understand their problems. And that's been something that Romney's been trying to deal with during this campaign.
And finally, what professional or creative achievement in Romney's life so far has surprised you the most?
Well, I didn't know a lot personally about his leadership of the Mormon Church in Massachusetts. My co-author Scott Hellman wrote about that. And there's a lot of detail in there about what he did. It was almost like a second job when he was at Bain Capital and then running over, because in the Mormon Church, you have lay leadership. He was the head of a group of churches in the Boston area. So I didn't know an awful lot about that. I didn't write that part of the book, but I learned an awful lot about that from my co-author's chapter about just what he did and how important a part of that of his life that was.
That was Michael Cranish. The book is The Real Romney. Michael, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.